For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. Coming up on the show today, Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka says his government is ramping up the fight against illegal drugs in the country.
This government will not tolerate criminal networks that profit from destroying lives.
Pacific Islanders have been identified as victim survivors of modern slavery in a new report.
Predominantly in Papua New Guinea, a few in Vanuatu, and a couple each from the Solomon Islands and Fiji.
And Solomon Islands soccer player Philip Mungo is poised to make his debut with his country's first fully professional team, the Solomon Kings. Those stories and more coming up here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific and coming to you from the traditional lands of the Pamarang people. But first, we start this morning with an update on PNG's surviving conjoined twin, Sawong Mithiam. The good news is Sawong is recovering well at the Sydney Children's Hospital less than a month after his brother, Tom, died during separation surgery. It comes after a long medical journey that saw him transferred to Australia for highly specialised surgery unavailable in PNG. Family spokesman Jürgen Rue was in Sydney to welcome the new year with baby Sawong, and it was Captain Rue who flew the twins out of rural Morobe province after their birth, and he was by the family's side during the surgery. He returned from Germany on New Year's Eve and visited Sawong in hospital, saying it was a memorable experience.
Well, so this picture, I see the picture of two fighters, no? We had a lot of challenges I had to fight through for him. But he too, you know, without his own determination, his will to live, you know, he wouldn't have made it. So he had the will to live. He hung on and we tried our best. We had a lot of doctors working hard. Wherever we went to, just looking at him, he really, really affected so many people just by looking at them. You know, a lot of people embraced him just by looking at him. And he had that fight in him. Wanting to live, and that's what we had to support.
You had to travel all the way from Germany to come to Sydney just to spend time with Sawong.
I went on holidays. It was a planned holiday every year. I just spent a few days with my mother during Christmas. She's a widow now for the last 2 years. And that's one thing I have to do for the person who made me who I am today. At least I spent Christmas with her. So I went down, had 6 great days with her. And came back now on the way back to Papua New Guinea. I decided to come via Sydney and see Sawong, see the parents, and also see my nurses who have been with them here, giving them all support. Spent New Year with them, and I took my nurses down to see the fireworks under the Sydney Harbour Bridge, which was great as well. It was an experience of a lifetime for us as well. And the 31st of December, had so many experiences of a lifetime. It was holding Sawong, looking into his eyes, and he looked into my eyes. And actually, when I moved my head, his eyes followed me around. And then we put him back into his cot again, and we went on to Sydney then and saw the fireworks. So it was a very good ending of the year.
Jürgen, you have done a lot of this, helped a lot of people in the rural communities around Papua New Guinea. Why is Sawong special to you?
It's number one, it's a conjoined twin, so it's a very rare event of having conjoined twins. And number two also is that he just looked into my eyes when he was 5 days old, and the way he looked into my eyes, like he had that expression of in his face where he was trying to say, "I just want to live," and I had to pull through for him through all the different challenges we've had. No, it was a very special. It just, you cannot express the feeling of having been able to hold him. And you can see there are a lot of wires and lines on him still, but most of that is just for the monitoring of his health. So they're always up to date with his vitals of his body. Some of the lines on him one of the lines on him is only for nutrition. So apart from him getting the milk from the mother, he is getting whatever they need to put him in respect of vitamins, minerals, just nutritions. And some lines are in place in case they need to access him quickly. They don't have to put cannulas in and this and that. So, but really meaningfully, he's getting a little bit of oxy still, and he's getting intravenous nutritious feeding, and that's it. The other lines, they are there for monitoring and just in case they need to get into him. But he is a very healthy boy.
Captain Jürgen Ruh speaking there to Hilda Wayne. We head now to Vanuatu, where New Year's Day celebrations have been marred by criminal activity, domestic violence, and disorderly behavior. The biggest shock was an armed robbery at the airport in the lead up to New Year's Day, where more than 8 million Vatu was stolen, and the suspects are still on the run from the law. And for more on this story, we go now to Port Vila, where our Vanuatu reporter, Lily Rose Wellwell, is standing by. Good morning, Lily Rose.
Good morning, Jordan. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Lily Rose, tell me, what's the latest update on this case? Are police getting any closer to arresting the suspects?
No, they're not getting any closer to getting the suspect. But like you said, the robbery was on the 30th at the international airport. Police initially reported that the money that was stolen was 80 million. But the figure was later corrected after confirmation with the FESCO, the financial provider, which says the amount taken was about 600 Australian dollars, roughly around 49 million Vatu. Also, that CCTV footage reviewed by police shows the suspects were not harmed, correcting early reports that suggested firearms or hosted situation, which was also reported by local media. The suspects remain at large several days on, and police investigations are continuing around Port Vila and the wider Vatu. The opposition leader was also in the media criticizing the police for the release of conflicting information, saying it caused confusion and anxiety in the community and calling for the authorities to restore public confidence.
And I understand that opposition leader Ismail Kausikal also says something to the effect of that it's not time for cowboys with guns. Is that what he was referring to there, what you just mentioned, or can you elaborate a bit more?
Yeah, he was. He said that because, you know, they were giving conflicting reports, and especially during the festive season. So he was saying it's not time to jump the gun, but just to ensure that you have all the accurate information in front of you before making a public statement, because the information that was reported was the official information that comes out from the police. A day later, 24 hours later, they were able to verify that through CCTV and the figures that it was not what they initially reported, what the commissioner initially stated. So that's why he was calling on them to ensure, as the authority, to ensure that they give out the correct information, not conflicting information.
Well, some important clarifications there. Moving away from the robbery, though, Lily Rose, there's also been a spike in domestic violence incidents. Can you take us through what's happened and how the community is responding?
Yeah, so police have made three arrests in relation connection to domestic violence, and they have been brought over to Port Vila for further investigation with authorities, treating domestic violence cases as a priority during these holidays. Isn't this because there's been a number of domestic violence cases? Community leaders and police are also reinforcing the message that domestic violence is a crime and is not a private matter. There's been a strong call for respect within families, and the police with the community leaders have run a number of awarenesses around different communities throughout Vanuatu, not just in Port Vila, and the campaign is on promoting safety, respect and accountability have been visible across communities during this period.
Yeah, and on that topic of safety and respect, there are also a lot of reports about antisocial behavior across this period. What's been reported during these New Year celebrations?
Well, it has been reported that there have been reports of vandalism, road damage and disorderly behavior, especially among young people, particularly during New Year's Eve celebration. So community leaders have condemned the action, and they're saying it undermines the public safety and further place a strain on infrastructure still recovering from last year's earthquake. So officials are calling for greater discipline and respect for public spaces, stressing the celebration should not come at the cost of community well-being.
I understand as well, on a bit of a different topic, there have been concerns raised about public and private beaches following a tragic drowning. What actions are authorities taking to address this?
So the police have issued safety warnings to public beaches and private beaches, and that is following the drowning of and the death of a 7-year-old. So authorities are especially calling for those who are charging entry fees to have trained wardens and basic safety measures in their beaches when the public is there. Police have also alighted caps in legislation, noting that Vanuatu has no formal designated public beaches despite widespread public use. So they're calling on owners and parents and guardians to closely supervise their children when they're near water at all times to avoid the incident that happened last time.
Yeah, incredibly tragic. Finally, Lily Rose, pivoting to something a little bit different around concerns over the New Year's period, and that is that there's been a shortage of kava in Port Vila. Tell me, what is the reason for this shortage and how is it affecting the local industry?
Well, you know, a lot of people in Vanuatu drink a lot of kava. So the shortage is mainly due to transportation delays from other islands, as domestic ships were prioritizing passengers and general cargo during the Christmas and New Year period, because a lot of people are going back to the islands for celebration during this period. So a demand peaked on New Year's Eve, forcing many kava pubs to close early or limit sales. So some larger operators chartered planes to bring in kava from the islands, but that option isn't affordable for smaller businesses. But they expect stock to recover in the coming days as the shipping schedule returns to normal. So it's normally due to transportation of the kava up to Port Vila.
Oh, and chartering private planes. Wow. Yeah, the demand is high.
Yeah, the demand is really high.
Well, Lily Rose, thank you so much for joining me here this morning to update us on what's going on in Vanuatu.
Thank you.
That was our reporter in Vanuatu, Lily Rose Wellwell. My name is Jordan Fennell, you're with me here on Pacific Beat. And still to come on the show, drugs and corruption. We head to Fiji for the latest on how the government is cracking down on the drug threat. And the country's Corruption Commission says there are hundreds of active investigations and they won't rule out cabinet ministers. That's next. Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka says his government is ramping up the fight against illegal drugs in the country. The Prime Minister says new measures will see the military assisting police to crack down on drug dealers and traffickers and counter what's being described as a methamphetamine epidemic. He says drugs from international cartels have infiltrated all levels of society and have become a scourge on the community. Mr. Rambuka used his New Year's Day address to explain how authorities are responding to the drug threat in Fiji.
Fiji faces serious challenges from illicit drugs and violent crimes. This government will not tolerate criminal networks that profit from destroying lives. We are strengthening enforcement, border controls, rehabilitation programs, and community-based prevention. We fully support our police and justice institutions as they work to restore safety in our streets and in our homes. I commend the Commissioner of Police and the dedicated men and women of the Fiji Police Force for their determination in restoring safety and public confidence. I also note the interest expressed by the Republic of Fiji military forces in supporting this national effort. With appropriate ministerial guidance, collaboration between the police force and the RMF will further strengthen our response, and this government will support such cooperation where necessary. Fighting transnational organized crime includes our maritime space. Regional cooperation is key, where the RMF, the Fiji Navy, will operate with our regional partners to deter, disrupt, and dismantle criminal syndicates, crime networks, and their business model. On the public health front, we are deeply concerned by the rise in HIV cases and to violence against women and children. We are responding through stronger education, expanded testing, improved treatment, and stigma-free outreach. This is not just a medical challenge. It is a shared national responsibility.
That was Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka highlighting how combating Fiji's growing drug problem will be a key priority for his government this year. And staying in Fiji, the head of Fiji's Independent Commission Against Corruption says there are active corruption investigations underway, some of these involving government ministers. So far, two senior government MPs, former Deputy Prime Ministers Manoa Kamikamita and Biman Prasad, have been charged and have cases before the courts. FICAC's Acting Commissioner Lavi Rakoika says her staff are involved in 200 corruption investigations, and she says cabinet ministers are potentially among those being investigated.
In terms of our investigation, no one is targeted and no one is protected. We use the same threshold for any person that has a file here within the commission. The fact that you are somebody that is unemployed on the street that has bribed an official, and if you're a member of parliament, that does not affect any investigations within. So I believe that that question in itself does not warrant an answer, because we do not deal with them based on who's in parliament, who's in opposition, who's in government. We deal with it when the file comes to us and we proceed.
Commissioner Rakoika also used a media conference to reject claims that FICAC has been weaponized as a tool against political opponents.
I've talked about the processes and procedures within the commission. The answer to it is no, we have not been weaponized. We do not take our instructions from anyone in government or in parliament. In terms of how we safeguard ourselves, that's why we have systems in place. Maybe I can add that at the end of the day, the decision comes to the office of the commissioner, but there are many people within the organization that deals with any one particular file. It's it's not just me. We have the complaints that goes through the complaint system. There's a manager there. It comes to legal. There's so many legal officers there. Goes to the manager. Then it goes to investigation. Even within investigation, there are investigators, there are team leaders, there are chief investigators. Then it goes to manager legal. We have processes within to ensure that no one person makes the ultimate makes a decision. There are many checks and balances within the commission to safeguard us from perception of bias or allegations of biasness.
FICAC itself has been at the center of controversy after its former head, Barbara Mali-Mali, was dismissed following the outcome of a commission of inquiry report. Ms. Mali-Mali has taken the government to court over her dismissal, and the appointment of her successor, Commissioner Rokoika, is also the subject of a legal challenge. And Pacific Beat will be keeping a close eye on all these developments from Fiji.
Nation footy is bigger and better. Join Sam and Tini Rau every Friday as they dive into the weekend's footy action and have plenty of laughs along the way. With insights from NRLW powerhouse Sala Tongatuki and Fiji Rugby Union icon Namani Kurundrani, you'll get the inside scoop on Pacifica talent making waves in both rugby league and union. Catch Nation Footy Fridays at 4pm PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport, and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church, or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6am PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell, and you're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Friday morning. And still to come on the show, lots of sports news. You'll hear from the sailors of the New Caledonian Yacht, BNC, that just lost out the Sydney to Hobart race. And Solomon Islands soccer player Philip Mungo is poised to make his debut with his country's first fully professional team, the Solomon Kings. You'll hear from him as well coming up very shortly. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Now, 371 reports of alleged modern slavery were reported to Australia's Federal Police for the 2024 to 2025 financial year. The figures were revealed in the latest report from the Australian Institute of Criminology, also known as AIC, with Pacific Islanders being identified as victim survivors in the report. Legislation in Australia recognises two types of offences, human trafficking and modern slavery, which includes sexual and domestic servitude, forced labour, or forced marriage. Dr. Samantha Bricknell from the research manager at the AIC told Lucy Cooper the report could help shape the future of policy.
This data has come from the AIC's newly established Human Trafficking and Modern Slavery National Minimum data set. We have 2 years of data, one between 23 and 24-25, but we're hoping to sort of have trend data going forward. So the most recent data that we have is from that 24-25 period, and we found that the Australian Federal Police received around 371 reports of alleged modern slavery, and of those, 132 were accepted for investigation and what we call not subsequently withdrawn. So those that that weren't accepted for investigation or not subsequently withdrawn were those where a modern slavery offence wasn't identified or detected, they couldn't make contact with a victim survivor, there were other entities or agencies that were better equipped to respond to that particular report, or there were vexatious claims or what have you. So of those that were accepted for investigation, what we're finding is predominantly they're around what's referred to as exit trafficking. So that's when a person is taken offshore, deceived or coerced to go offshore, so from Australia to any other part of the world. And that was around almost a third of offences. And around 29% were related to forced marriage. And then smaller proportions were around sexual servitude. That was around 14% of offences. Now, that is predominantly in the commercial sex industry, but not exclusively so. So you may have sexual servitude attached to other modern slavery offences, such as forced marriage. And then around 10% or 8% were forced labour. So that's around labour exploitation. And that covers a sort of a very broad spectrum of behaviours that the perpetrator enacts on the victim survivor.
And I'm wondering how what we know about the past 12 months of modern slavery reports and human trafficking reports in Australia, how might this compare to previous years?
So we've only got 2 years of data, and it's pretty comparable across the two years of data. Now, the AFP have over the years been publishing few statistics about what they're receiving in terms of alleged reports, but in terms of the sorts of modern slavery offences that are being reported and investigated by the AFP, it's pretty consistent. So it is that predominantly exit trafficking and forced marriage, and then smaller amounts of sexual servitude and forced labour. Now, that's based on reports to the AFP. So the real picture of what's happening with modern slavery in Australia could be slightly different, and it may be because victim survivors, depending on their circumstances and the conditions that they find themselves in, that reporting is not necessarily occurred. So forced labour is probably a case in point where we think it's probably an undercount of forced labour that's occurring in Australia.
Do we have any information or know anything about people born in the Pacific region in relation to modern slavery in Australia?
We do. So if we step back into 23 of the victim survivors identified in 22-23 had been born in the Pacific, so predominantly in Papua New Guinea, a few in Vanuatu, and a couple each from the Solomon Islands and Fiji. So they made up around 15% of the victim survivors that were identified by the AFP in that time, and they were predominantly victim survivors of forced labour, and again, predominantly victim survivors of forced labour who had been enslaved within the agriculture and horticultural industry in Australia. Now, those numbers dropped off a little bit in 24-25, so we only had five victim survivors identified in 24-25 by the AFP. So that was 4%. So we've gone from 15% in 22-23 down to 4% in 24-25. We feel that maybe, and not suggesting that all victim survivors who are born in the Pacific Islands are necessarily going to be victim survivors of forced labour, but that seems to be the pattern that we have seen in Australia.
How can Australia strengthen its response to modern slavery?
So Australia's done a huge amount of work, and that's both government, law enforcement and civil society in strengthening modern slavery. So there's been a lot of work in terms of strengthening the legislation, strengthening protections, strengthening support services that are available to victim survivors. There's been an increase in prosecution of DPP matters, but there's also been a lot of work around community awareness. Probably still a lot more work needs to be done around community awareness, in the sense that people, there's probably still a bit of misunderstanding particularly what modern slavery is. And I think people have saw these misconceptions of people being shackled in bunkers. But it's a very different scenario to that. That's not to suggest that the scenario is any less distressing or traumatic to the victim survivor. There are so many barriers to victim survivors of modern slavery to report matters. You know, they fear their lives, they fear retribution to themselves or their families. They don't have the mechanisms to report. They may not even see themselves as a victim survivor of modern slavery, so they don't necessarily know who to reach out to. So still some work, obviously, with a broader community, but also being able to reach out to victim survivors so that they feel safe and know where to seek help.
Dr. Samantha Bricknell, the research manager at the Australian Institute of Criminology, speaking there to Lucy Cooper.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tierney from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Island Music with Rick Howe, Saturday from 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia. Yours in the Pacific.
Want to catch up or listen again to your favourite ABC Radio Australia programs anytime, anywhere? From Pacific Beat to Stories from the Pacific, Nisian Footy to Culture Compass. You can listen to your top shows on your favourite podcast app on the go and for free. Just search for your favourite ABC Radio Australia program in your podcast app and press play. ABC Radio Australia, bringing you more ways to listen.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, and my name is Jordan Fennell. To some sports news now, and for a moment there, it seemed the prestigious Sydney to Hobart yacht race would have a Pacific winner. After leading the race for 626 nautical miles, and with just 2 miles left and the finish line in sight, New Caledonian yacht BNC used a pole to steady its sail. But race judges ruled the tactic illegal, penalising BNC and handing rival yacht Min River the overall winner's title. For the BNC crew, it was a silly but costly mistake, with crew member Michael Quinton saying they were unaware of it.
The decision was difficult to listen, but it's sport, it's life. We respect the decision of the international jury. So we thought we could manage to have a smaller penalty, but that's the choice. We lose the race for just nothing, but we are really happy of our race. We enjoyed it. We feel like we have that something really special on this race, and that's the principle. We still are. We think for us, we have won the race for us. our race.
I think there are storms offshore, and this was a storm that we never experienced. Media and other stuff, and onshore. But I think we manage that quite well, and we go through this too, so we're happy about the race we did.
It's a silly mistake.
I can explain. I do match racing, so when we arrived in the bay just there, the wind was very low, and the wind dropped, so we started to get the anchor out of the boat. So Michel was down and trying to get the anchor out to mooring, so we were not going backwards. And I was preparing the anchor, and then I left my heads up, and the wind just came back by the other way. So the boat made a round, so we lost the control of the boat, and the wind came back, and we were just at 2 knots going on the shore because we wanted to be on the side so there's no current. And at some point, Michel told me, won't be ley line of the red point, so we need to jibe. But if we jibe, we go back in the current. And I told him, because I do match racing, maybe we can do a butterfly, like in match racing. And he told me, it won't work. The boat is not made for that. I said, yeah, so let's jibe. He said, I don't want to jibe. Said, so let's try. So we tried first, and I did a human pull butterfly to put the butterfly, and it worked. And so when we went to the point when we decided to go straight to the line, we were in butterfly, and because it was just the finishing line, we wanted to prepare the boat, to clean the boat, all the shit and all rounds, because we knew the media were here. So Michel and we decided together, let's put the pole, because so I don't have to stand like that until the finishing line, so I can prepare the boat for the media and for everything after. So we put the pole to prepare the boat and all the stuff after. So this is how it happened.
We didn't know the rule.
The rule is good. Yeah, it's well written.
We took time to understand the rule because in English we were not understanding some words. But it make it clear yesterday night that we had broken a rule.
But we had to call somebody. When we realized the protest, for us we didn't understand the rule. So we called a French expert jury in France, who told us, who explained us the rule. So it took us until 11 p.m. yesterday to work on that. And once we realized that we broke the rule, it's too late to do a declaration. So this morning the race committee came and asked us if we accept to do a declaration of breaking a rule. And we straight away accepted it because we knew about that. So I think this is part of the process. So the real question is not about this. We broke a rule.
That was New Caledonia's BNC crew member Michael Quinton, and speaking before him was teammate Jan Rigal. Now, goalkeeper Philip Mungo has played more than 40 times for the Solomon Islands national soccer team and represented four different clubs, but always at an amateur or semi-professional level. However, that is not the case anymore because Mungo is poised to make his debut in a couple of weeks' time for his country's first fully professional team, the Solomon Kings. One of the five Pacific Island sides to feature in the brand new OFC Pro League, the Kings were a little late to the party, and as a result, one or two homegrown players they would have loved to have had in their lineup have slipped through the net. Nevertheless, Philip Mungo has high hopes for the squad, although time is short as he and his teammates adapt to an unfamiliar training regime.
It's very different from what we used to. Professional is more organized. It's more demanding. You have to turn up early so you prepare yourself for the training season as well. The main idea is to provide a professional environment for local players in Solomons, give them the chance to experience the environment as well.
You're currently at a training camp in Brisbane, as I understand it. I mean, what's the thinking behind that?
The main idea to come out here is to train as a team, and we're still waiting for two players at the moment. We just only train with 21 players, including one Australian player, so we're still waiting for other foreign players to come. They are coming from Indonesia. They are playing in Indonesia national team as well, so we are still waiting for them to join the team.
And for you personally, you're 30. That's quite old for a player to turn professional, but this must be for you a life's ambition achieved.
Exactly. To become a professional, it's a big, big dream as well. But then for me, in the age category that's supposed to be concentrated in coaching or other things, but then once I've given the chance, the opportunity, it's an honor for me to represent this club, and for me to end my football career in a high note, it's a dream come true for me as well.
And you have ambitions to coach also. Indeed, you've already been coaching over the last couple of years from time to time. Are you involved in coaching at all with Solomon Kings?
At the moment, we don't have any goalkeeper coach, so I'm doing both just to help the younger goalkeepers selected to be part of the professional team. The main idea is after this professional contract for 6 months, then I'm looking into involving coaching to help out with Solomon Kings as well.
Your first game with the Kings will be on the 18th of January against PNG Hikari FC. How do you view that prospect? They've recruited three players from Brazil as their overseas players, which gives them a bit of a glamorous look.
To be honest, we respected other teams as well, like Hikari. They got some players from Solomon, Brazil, and Vanuatu. It's a tough game for us. We need to mentally prepare ourselves for this first game. It's not going to be easy, but I do believe in these boys. We can have for our first game, so it's going to be an interesting game for us as well.
What are your thoughts about the format of the competition? The first round in New Zealand, and then you will move to other locations, to Fiji, to Australia, of course to Solomon Islands as well in March. And each time you move, it'll be three games in a week. It's quite demanding, I would have thought, for first-time professional players.
Yes, it's a new thing for us Solomon Islands players, but we have to just prepare for whatever situation that is come ahead of us.
How would you describe anticipation back home in the Solomons? Solomons people love their football. What does it mean to people who follow the sport in Solomon Islands to have their own professional team?
I think for Solomon people, it's a new era. And yeah, everyone is looking forward to serving the boys and also support when we play our match in Honiara. There will be a lot of supporters standing out to support. Even they got other Solomon players who are playing for other teams as well, like South Island from New Zealand. We have one of our strikers there, Rohu, and also John Orbulu is playing with Hikari. So, yeah, definitely there will be a lot of people coming out to watch the games.
Those players that have gone to other teams, do you know why they made the choice to do that rather than put their hand up to play for the Kings?
I think it depends on the contract and also the clubs approach those players first, and they already signed a contract before Solomon Kings reached out to them.
What is your level of anticipation now, just a couple of weeks away from playing that first game as a professional?
Oh yeah, for me, I really look forward for the first game, and I've been with these boys back home training and then came here in Richmond to train, because we know it's not going to be easy, but you can tell the boys the excitement. I can see the boys are looking forward to the first game.
Solomon Kings goalkeeper Philip Mungo looking ahead to the OFC Pro League's big kick and his team's historic first game against PNG Hikari FC in 2 weeks' time. And Philip was talking there to Richard Hewitt on the line from the Kings training camp in Brisbane. Now, a young woman from New South Wales with Solomon Islands heritage is one of 16 winners in this year's ABC Haywire competition. The program gives 16 to 22-year-olds from regional, rural and remote Australia a chance to share their personal stories with the nation. For Mesa, reconnecting with her heritage led her to write a powerful theatre drama inspired by her great-grandfather's experiences during the Second World War. Through that creative journey, she's rediscovered links to her Solomon Islands roots and showcased how storytelling can bring cultures and generations together.
I always knew I wanted to create something original, something honouring my Pacific Islander heritage. But growing up in Australia, I lived far from my island and culture. As I got older, I became more curious. So, in my last year of high school, using my drama class, I found a way to reunite with my ethnic background.
For the Solomon Islands, water is everything. The center, giver, taker, creator and destroyer, it revolves around us. Because we are saltwater people.
I remember being told stories about my great-grandfather from the Solomon Islands, who fought in the Second World War. He had become an almost mythic figure in my family, feared by many. His story became the inspiration for my Year 12 drama monologue. At first, I struggled to put pen to paper. I wanted to write something powerful, but I was scared of getting it wrong. I started falling behind in class and staying back at school. Finally, I reached out to a relative online who was a custom man living in the Solomon Islands. I told Uncle Natty my story about falling behind in class, my hesitance to portray this culturally sensitive piece, and my drive to learn more about my history. His words were, and I quote, "Let Mesa stand as evidence of the great ancestor." After that message, my approach to the story shifted. Using his line, I quoted him into my monologue and began playing the story as if I were my great-grandfather. I tied mythical legends into a World War II setting, linking ocean metaphors and themes of sorcery behind cultural beliefs like black magic.
Although we don't speak of the dead, there is one story that we accept. One story which describes the man who saved us from war. World War II. And I stand as evidence of the great ancestors.
The piece was selected for a state showcase. This year, I traveled to the Solomon Islands with my family. I had only been there once before, when I was about 10. It was surreal being in the place I had written about. After the first week, my dad encouraged me to approach a local theatre company, asking to perform my drama piece. A few days later, I was on stage in front of the Dreamcast theatre group and my extended family. It was terrifying. Far more scary than when I performed to a crowd of 700 in Sydney. But through the support of my family and audience, the performance made me realize how important storytelling is to Solomon Islander culture and to me. And even though I live thousands of kilometers away, storytelling will always be a way for me to connect back to my Pacific Islander heritage.
And that was Mesa, a beautiful story, one of the winners of the ABC's Haywire Storytelling Competition. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat this morning. A quick look back at our top story today. Baby Sawong, the surviving conjoined twin from PNG, is recovering well in Sydney after a long medical journey that saw him transferred overseas for highly specialized surgery unavailable in PNG.
Without his own determination, his will to live, you know, he wouldn't have made it. So he had the will to live. He hung on, and he had that fight in him.
Such beautiful news. Well, thank you for your company this morning. Aggie Tupo will be back next week on Monday at 6 a.m. PNG time. But stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia right now, because news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daily.